ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're the Prime Minister. What's your first move? Make Australia a green energy superpower. Fix the housing crisis. Treat mental health as a national priority. The Economy Stupid is talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
Hello and welcome to a special summer edition of ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, recorded on stage at a Crime Writers Festival. Let's head into the audience to hear what happened. Who done it? Why done it? And where in time was all of it done? Yes, we're talking historical crime. Stories I'm tempted to say are Homeric or biblical, but in truth, we're only travelling back a century or two. Hello and welcome to this session on Bloody Histories, where we're reimagining the past in historical crime fiction, here at the Bad Sydney Crime Festival and on ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. I should add too that we're on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the original storytellers of this place. And we're also speaking here at the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts, an institution that has supported reading and education since the 1830s. My name's Kate Evans from ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. Delighted to be here with three authors of historical crime fiction. Nalima Rao, creator of the Akal Singh series set in Fiji, whose latest and second in that series is A Shipwreck in Fiji. Michael Berg, journalist and novelist whose books include Tank Water and Dirt Trap, but we're going to be concentrating on his latest today, The Watch Night, and Lainey Anderson, also a journalist and novelist and creator of the Kate Cox series of novels set in Adelaide, the second of which, Murder on North Terrace, has just been published. She's also written a PhD on the real historical figure of Kate Cox. More on that soon. Why not welcome them all again? Now, what I've asked each of these writers to do is to take us to the place and time where their stories are set. So, first to you, Lainey Anderson. Your character, policewoman Kate Cox, and her sidekick, Ethel Bromley, walk the streets of Adelaide in World War One. What version of the city do they see?
Thank you for having me. World War One, Adelaide, it's woman dominated. Women are actively involved in making the city patriotic. Women are incredibly patriotic. The city is the third largest city in Australia at the time in 1917. And it sort of looks a little bit like it does today, except the Verco building is the largest building. It's only six stories high. So the built environment is really quite similar to what we see today, but socially it's very different. So even though women are running the Red Cross and a whole plethora of volunteer agencies with as much skill and aplomb as their husbands are running the army, women have very few rights, and that's what Kate and Ethel see, Miss Cox and Ethel see, women who are forced to stay in marriages that are very dysfunctional and violent, women who can't get a bank account without their father or their husband, women who don't have inheritance rights, custody rights. So that's the side of Adelaide that Miss Cox and Ethel are grappling with.
We'll get back to those streets soon. But Nalima Rao, the year is the same, but the streets are very different. Your character, Akal Singh, is in Fiji. What does Fiji look like to him?
Yeah, so Fiji, 1915, it's still a fledgling British colony at that point, and there's a lot of change going on in Fiji. So there's the economy is based on sugar plantations, CSR, So still on shelves today in Australia. So and in order to keep that the sugar plantations viable, they need cheap labour. And that cheap labour is being brought in from India. So Indians are being brought in as indentured labourers to work in the sugarcane fields. So Fijians are still the majority. The next biggest grouping of people in Fiji at that time are the Indians, who are mostly living on the plantations. And there's another group of people called the Europeans, which is anyone who is not one of those other two groups. So an Australian would be called a European, a Brit, a German, everyone's a European. So the Indians who are being brought in are being brought in under indentured labour contracts, which were quite oppressive and exploitative. But of course, they were the poorest of the poor. They were illiterate. They couldn't read what they were signing up to. And the people who were signing them up were paid by bums on seats on the ships. So they were not always truthful about what people were signing up for. So there's a lot of political and social turmoil in the country. And at the same time, we've got the backdrop of World War One, and a lot of paranoia about Germans, which seems a little odd for a little country in the South Pacific, but they were very concerned about Germans lurking about in Fiji.
And already we're getting such a great sense of how agile crime fiction is and all of the different things that historical crime fiction can do. But Michael Berg, we're travelling back further in time with your fiction, another 60 years into regional New South Wales in the early 1850s. Tell us about this place that you're interested in that's defined by the Fish River Caves.
Well, for those of us who may have been to Jenolan Caves for a school excursion or a family holiday many years ago, there's one mental picture of Jenolan Caves, but the image of that that I've recreated in the Watch Night, as you said, it's many decades before that and there was no road there. Everyone remembers the winding road down to Jenolan. This is a place which was about as much of a wilderness as Westerners and settlers could conceive of. It's a place that they viewed with suspicion more than we view it with wonder today, the wonder of geology, the wonder of ancient soils and rocks and formations of crystal. This was a place which was not free of human inhabitants. Of course, it's the traditional lands of the Barabara people, a clan group of the Gundungurra Nation. And this was a place where a great arch in the rock, this massive chunk of limestone that had been uplifted millions of years before, but the actions of water over many, many, many millions of years, underground rivers had formed from above ground rivers over that time, and it created the grand archway that we call it now. But whatever name it had in those years, I don't know, but it would have had a name from the original First Nations inhabitants who lived there, and we can still hear those stories today from them.
And I want to get to the research that you've all done and the issues that you've faced as you've written your novels. But let's lean into the crime fiction side of things for a while. Nalima, what's the central crime that sets your man running in this latest novel?
That's an interesting question, because he is sent to the town of Levuka, which is the historical capital of Fiji, on a series of sort of wild goose chases, a series of nuisance errands that are another mark of disgrace to this man who's already been a little bit disgraced in the past. So he is sent to Levuka to escort a couple of Australian women who are needing to go to Levuka as tourists and to do a couple of other things. And he's there to supervise a young police officer and train him up a little bit. And the final insulting task that he's been given is to, there's been rumours of Germans lurking about in Levuka, so he's off to follow up on this wild goose chase of Germans, which he doesn't expect. He's basically just like, I'm going on a holiday, I'm going to a new place, I haven't seen it before. His friend Taviti is going with him, so, and Taviti is from that area, so he's just taking this as, it's fine, I'm just going to have a bit of fun. But when he gets there, there is a local Indian man, a shopkeeper, who's been killed. And the suggestion is that these mysterious Germans have killed him. So suddenly the Germans seem like maybe they're real.
And because it's often the case that there's not just one crime in a crime novel. And so you've already demonstrated that. There's the crime that he thought he was investigating, and then other things happen and it keeps building.
Yeah, absolutely. It wouldn't be a crime novel if only one body dropped. So there's got to be some other people dying. And there's also a group of European soldiers who have been shipwrecked, hence a shipwreck in Fiji, and they managed to offend the local village by killing and eating a turtle. And that's taboo in the Fijian culture. So in the Fijian culture, that is exclusively for the chief. The turtle is exclusively for the chief. And because they've killed and eaten a turtle, the local Fijian village take these men prisoner. And then Akal is then trying to negotiate to get them released because they are also suspected of having killed the shopkeeper. So, yeah, he's got a tough job for what he thought was going to be a fun holiday.
And that also very nicely raises that question of which laws are transgressed, how they're understood, whose sense of justice gets to win out. Now, Lainey, of all these three novels, yours begins with the most dramatic crime scene. And I could say to you, paint me a picture of it, but that would be a little tasteless in the circumstances, wouldn't it?
Yes, so in another life I would have loved to have been an art historian. So for my second novel, the murder takes place in the art gallery of South Australia, which it is today. And when I was researching the story, I found a painting that actually caused widespread outrage and mass visitation to the art gallery just before the First World War. So the body is found beneath this scandalous painting of a nude woman who isn't just painted sort of in the Grecian style that was quite popular at the time. She is so human in her nakedness that women blush and men flock. So about half the state's population flocked to see this painting over 8 months before it was defaced and removed. But funnily enough, the male board members put it in the boardroom. So I thought that would be a bit of a romp to bring this painting back, which was turfed back to England and Sir William Orpen in between the wars.
The artist,
who became quite a famous war artist in the First World War, and replaced with some really boring actual copy of another of his paintings. So I wanted to bring that story to life as well with a very dramatic murder of one of the board members. Yeah, so Miss Cox, it's only 6 months after the first crime where they solved the murder of Dora Black. Miss Cox doesn't really want anything to do with it. She wants to get back to the business of prevention and preventing immorality, which is what she does with her 5 foot cane. So, but Ethel receives an anonymous tip and an anonymous letter about the murder, because she's in the Adelaide's elite sort of set, and Ethel gets embroiled into it with the detective branch and sort of goes off on this rollicking ride with it.
So just explain that context, though, because your protagonists, Kate and Ethel, they aren't usually caught up in homicide, are they? So what are the types of crimes that they're usually concerned with?
So the Women's Police Branch, it was formed in 1915. It was the first of its, or they were the first policewomen in the British Empire employed on the same salary and with the same powers of arrest as men. Kate Cox had been a juvenile probation officer for 9 years before that. So when they announced the formation of a Women's Police Branch, she didn't even put up her hand. She believed she was good enough to just get the job. She was 40. She was single. She was strictly Methodist. She loved clothes, and when they came into fashion, she loved a tight perm. She was very single-minded, had a great sense of worth. So she was selected to lead this Women's Police Branch. But really their job, there was a global moral panic at the time with, you know, so many men going off to war and the death of so many fathers. There was this worry about delinquency in children, but also that women were being given these jobs that had always been taken up by men. So women were getting increasing financial independence and, gee, maybe even a little bit experimental with their sexual endeavours. So her job really was to prevent immorality and to protect women and children from harm. They met every train that was coming in from major regional centres and from interstate so that they could take in hand any vulnerable, unaccompanied young women and make sure that they found their way to a hostel or somewhere where they were safe, so where they weren't picked up by opportunistic men. And they would patrol the streets up to, say, 11, 12, 1 o'clock at night, making sure that young couples weren't acting immodestly and potentially young women weren't getting themselves into situations where they would become pregnant and then potentially, yeah, be in the worst state of their lives.
Lainey Anderson, whose latest novel is Murder on North Terrace. I'm Kate Evans and you're listening to a summer edition of ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, recorded at the 2025 Bad Sydney Crime Festival. The other guests are novelists Nalima Rao and Michael Berg.
But Michael Berg, your novel doesn't begin with an obvious crime, although there's plenty of murky behaviour to be getting on with. And you're interested in noir too, I think, with your earlier work. So where does crime and history intersect for you in this novel?
Well, that's a very good question. The society that I've recreated in The Watch Night is what I'd call a frontier Methodist outpost. And it sounds there's similarities between these books, but The Watch Night is set right on the edge, as I said, of the frontier in the 1850s, and the further away organized faith got from the centers of populations, the kind of more careless it got with the doctrines and with the standards of those faiths. And so there was a Methodist community out at Old Bullock Flat, which is the old name for Oberon. And I found it very intriguing as a writer because the atmosphere of a faith-based community on the frontier is just, I thought, just lent itself to dark deeds. And I wanted to use crime as a metaphor, or in writerly terms, really an allegory, because there were wider crimes happening at that time, as we know, on the frontier with the frontier wars. There were crimes against First Nations people. There were crimes against women. There were crimes against people of alternate sexuality right through the colonial experience. That's a very, very big subject to tackle, and it's something that I think that too many people are tone deaf about. I wanted to inject those themes into a crime novel, which I think is an accessible way to have those thematic discussions, because it's very serious. Crime is a very serious issue, but a crime novel is a relatively benign vessel to have those big themes in. And that was my aim of marrying that history with the devastation, the high stakes that comes from these dark deeds, murder, other serious assaults, particularly in a religious community. It's just a case of juxtaposition. And so while I think the crimes that I've written about in The Watch Night are fictitious, the setting, the potential for crime and these larger crimes against humanity were certainly very, very real. But I wanted to create an atmosphere where people who were perhaps in a more general sense perpetrating these larger crimes against humanity were themselves being exposed to this unknown feeling of dread because of actual crimes in their community. And so I have a few main characters. This was a bit of a protagonist team in The Watch Night. And I've got these reactions in the hands of people who, for different reasons, have secrets around their past, and they generally involve crime. So we have a cast of criminals, civilized criminals, I suppose they'd see themselves as, or people with secrets from the past. Also, in that colonial era, we have convicts, of course, you know, the root word of that is just is dripping with crime. And people who have come to a new country, leaving secrets behind. So it was just a marrying crime and history was a way to get an accessible view on some of these big things that I think we just, I'm guilty of this myself. It's too big to think about in real life. Some of those frontier wars, there's a lot of stuff we need to process there. And I felt passionate about putting that into a package like a crime novel.
Well, I think you're playing around quite a bit with genre there because it could also perhaps be described as a gothic western.
Yes.
Here at the Bad Sydney Crime Festival and on ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, I'm Kate Evans, here with writers Michael Berg, Nalima Rao and Lainey Anderson. Now, Lainey, you haven't just taken us into a historical milieu or pursued an interest in early Adelaide and used it as a vehicle for crime fiction. I mean, you've taken a real historical figure. So what was it about the real Kate Cox that both took your interest and let you know you could use her imaginatively?
Well, I was actually just sort of nodding along to Michael then because I started studying Kate or Miss Cox as a PhD, and then because I'm of my journalist background, it might have been easier and sort of a more sort of traditional way to go to do a biography on her. But I didn't want just people that sort of already knew her to be interested in this story. I wanted to bring her back to life for the widest possible audience. And so because she was sort of so authentically herself and so, I mean, one of her former police commissioners said she was the most unorthodox police officer he'd ever sort of watched, and she would march into the house of an abusive husband and make him get down on his knees and recite the Lord's Prayer. She was so courageous but so singular that Kerry Greenwood, she did, what an amazing job she did with Phryne Fisher, but Kate Cox is just so, you couldn't make up some of the stuff she did. So I just thought she's just perfect for a murder mystery. And, you know, as Michael said, I wanted the widest possible audience to be taken along on a rollicking murder mystery, but they're actually getting hit over the head with history on every page. And that was my intention. And I just thought murder mystery, it's actually quite a skill because you really have to take your characters along on an emotional journey, and there has to be a real character arc as well as the murder arc so that people got to know who Miss Cox was. I went to great lengths to try and find out everything I could about her because I knew that I was taking a liberty in creating her and drawing on her real-life character and turning her into a fictional character 100 years later. Is that fair? I tell myself that it is because the archive is still there. Everything that we know about her, the primary sources are still all there for, and I just wanted to start a conversation about her. I'm not aiming to end it. I just wanted people to know, not just about her. When I was doing my PhD, I got really quite cranky at the idea that women were sort of written out of the World War One story. And I know that 60,000 young Australian men lost their lives overseas, and it's fair that we give them their due deserves, incredible sacrifice and service. But women were so bloody amazing in World War One, in both wars, despite, you know, not being able to serve. Female doctors had to go and serve in Scotland, and, you know, women wanted to serve, but they did every waking minute they were raising money. £14 million were raised by the Red Cross alone in Australia. So 14,000 care packages going overseas every month. And yet we don't know these things because we focus so heavily on the male war effort. So that was another driving force for making a really accessible story that people could learn about what women were doing, not just Kate Cox as a biography, but as a fictional character, bringing in lots of women's stories into it.
And it is a very complex and a nuanced view of that period, I'd have to say. But Nalima Rao, there are real figures walking through your novels too. but some of them emerge partly from your own family history. So what was it about the Indian indentured labourers of Fiji that you wanted to understand?
Yeah, so I think we've all got quite similar stories on that. So for me, I grew up in Australia. We moved to Australia when I was 3 from Fiji. And I knew that my ancestors or somewhere in the dim and distant past, my Indian forebears had gone to Fiji to work as indentured labourers. But I knew nothing about it. And I am Fijian Indian. So when I started doing research for this book, part of my goal was to bring to life the story of the indentured labourers. And like both Lainey and Michael, I wanted to do it in an accessible way. So my goal was that a tourist sitting on a beach in Fiji could be reading this book and hopefully enjoying a fun romp, but also learning about the history of the place that they're in and some of the darker parts of the history and learning about why there are so many Indians in Fiji, which may not have been obvious. And I've forgotten the original question. You're going to have to ask it again.
Well, it was a sort of double one because I was both interested in the real figures but also the sense that some of the figures that haunt your novel have walked out of your personal story as well as out of the archive.
Yeah, so I have I've not put any of my actual family history. I tried to do some family history research in Fiji when I was researching for the first book, and it was really hard. They've got in the National Archives in Fiji, they've got paper books, so nothing's digitized. They've got the books that have all of the catalogues of all the Indians who came off the ships in Fiji, but most of these people were illiterate, so they couldn't spell their names. They couldn't write it down themselves. So they'd get on a ship in India and give their names. They're long and complicated names. My great-grandmother's name was Aliamma, and it'd get written down one way in India. Then they'd get off the ship in Fiji, it'd get written down a different way. They'd get married, it'd get written down a different way. They'd have a baby, it'd get written down a different way. I gave up in the end. I could not find any of my grandparents. But there are some real characters. So our ship captain, who has been captured for eating the turtle, is based on a real historical figure. I can't say too much because of spoilers, but if and when you read the book, who he is revealed to be is a real character who is larger than life. So go Google it once you've read the book. I can't say more. And then my protagonist, Akal Singh, Sergeant Akal Singh, so he's basically a Sikh police officer who started his career in Hong Kong and was doing really, really well in Hong Kong and then makes an embarrassing mistake and gets basically exiled to Fiji in disgrace. And when I was first trying to write a book set in Fiji around indentured labourers, I originally had two female protagonists. It was a dual timeline. It was a completely different story and I was getting nowhere with it. And then as I was reading the old newspapers, the Fiji Times from the early 1900s, I came across mention of these Sikh police officers. So they were struggling to set up the police force in Fiji. And the governor of Fiji was speaking to the governor of Hong Kong, who was the ex-governor of Fiji, complaining about his police force. And the governor of Hong Kong said, "I've got these great guys. I'll send you 10 Sikh police officers." So 10 Sikh police officers went from Hong Kong to Fiji, did themselves proud. They sent another 10 and the next 10 weren't that good, so they stopped sending them. So Akal came out of that research because when I found these police officers in these newspapers, I was like, this is brilliant. That's my protagonist. That's somebody. And my original female character in the earlier timeline was a indentured labourer girl who was basically like next thing to a slave. She had no autonomy of movement. How was she investigating a crime? Whereas a police officer can investigate a crime. So,
And that's why we have such an interesting police procedural. But Michael Berg, what I'm enjoying is getting a sense of both the fiction and the characters that emerge from the past, like the real characters. And so you talked about that, the sort of Methodist revival history. Can you give us more of a sense of what was going on and who the real characters were on which you could then create your fiction?
The very first real-life people who inspired the Watch Night were the pioneering female explorers of Jenolan Caves. Now, I worked as a tour guide at Jenolan Caves for 4 years, from 2008 to 2012, and it became apparent to me very quickly on starting that job that the whole place is just a big rock full of stories, and there'd be easily be 20, 30, 40 novels to capture those stories. It's an oral tradition which is handed down, has been handed down since the 19th century for the settler stories, and then much more ancient stories, of course, from the Burraburra people. And it took me a long time to work out my way into those stories, but initially it was through those very early, very almost mythological female cave explorers. I went back a further generation to find what I could about the life of a woman called Jane Falls. Now, Jane Falls was an Irish settler. She came here with her mother and brothers, left behind a dead father back in Ireland. And this community lived so close to the caves, relatively close to the caves, that the caves became a place that they would visit fairly often. And they saw the place through the lens of their faith. It baffled them more often than they could make sense of it. It was, to many Methodists, the gateway to the underworld. In fact, John Wesley, of the Wesleyan Methodist faith, often wrote about caves being the gateway to the underworld, no matter which part of the world you found yourself in. So I couldn't find enough information about Jane Falls to make her the character in The Watch Night. I just couldn't, in good faith, for whatever she achieved, her stories hang in the oral tradition of Jenolan Caves, and we just couldn't find enough definitive information about her. So I recreated her as a character called Una Farry, an Irish settler, and she's got all the hallmarks that I felt on an instinctive level were those that Jane Falls had: courage, resilience. She had basically her life laid out before her in terms of work around the home, eventually marriage. But I thought, I'm going to take this back a little bit in time to a time that we can pinpoint Jane Falls in 1854, when she wrote her full name, not just her initials, but her full name on the walls of one of the caves at Jenolan. And if it exists, because it has been recorded, but it's very difficult to find again, if it exists, it's one of the earliest settler names recorded on the walls of the cave. And it's not just in a daylight cave, it's in a very deep place. So Jane made her way into that cave as a youngish woman, and I thought, wow. She had other women follow her a generation later, and their stories we know a little bit more about, but not really enough. Again, as we know, unless women were in extreme trouble with the law or incredibly pioneering in a visible sense, they're almost invisible, and it's far too easy for women to disappear in the history. So I couldn't quite write Jane, but I certainly imbued Una Farry with as much of that adventurous, resilient, faith-based, but also a great inner life that it's a bit of a spoiler to explain how she breaks from that faith-based community, but it is the caves that lead the way for her. She's surrounded by all kinds of other characters, but your question was about the inspiration, and that was my way in, was Jane's story through Una and the community around her.
And the great fun of illuminating a character in historical fiction is that she's not only illuminated, she is illuminated by using beef tallow candles that sputter and smell, which is something that you think about as you read a novel like this. Yeah. Here at Bad Sydney Crime Festival and on ABC Radio National, we're talking crime fiction and history, bloody histories, dark underbellies, and, of course, caves. Now, these are all weighty issues and stories and histories, which of course fiction can readily address, but crime as a genre is also entertaining, plot-filled. It's a page-turner. So why don't we get a taste of your style from all three of you, and I'm going to get you to do a reading that gives us a sense of what you're doing. So, Nalima, do you want to kick us off?
Akal and Taviti are staying at the local Fijian village. Taviti's uncle is the chief of the village, so Taviti is his heir apparent. They've just woken up and they have learnt that there's some kerfuffle going on and they're needed to come in and check out what's happening. Directly ahead of them, a remarkable scene was playing out on the beach. Six European men were surrounded by a group of Fijian warriors armed with spears. The Europeans stood back to back in a tight circle with their hands in the air as the spears jabbed dangerously close to their necks. They had clearly been taken by surprise as they all had pistols and holsters on their belts, but none of them had drawn their weapons. One of the Fijians was reaching through and systematically disarming them while another tied their hands. A few feet away, a cache of goods lay on the white sand, coiled ropes, wooden crates of tinned food, and other odds and ends. When they noticed the interlopers, a few of the warriors switched their attention to Akal and Taviti, spears bristling and then dipping when they realised who it was. Penai broke off and came to talk to them. He and Taviti engaged in a brief, intense conversation, which Taviti then summarised for Akal. The fishermen saw the camp and a turtle carcass this morning as they were going to fish, but didn't see the Europeans. They must have caught a turtle and eaten it last night. This is taboo. Only the chief may eat turtle. The fishermen came back and told my uncle, who sent the warriors out to capture whoever it was. The camp was still empty when the warriors arrived, so they hid in the jungle. When the Europeans returned to their camp, the warriors surprised and captured them. Akal held his tongue while Taviti told this outlandish story. But as soon as Taviti stopped talking, Akal burst out. This much fuss over a turtle? Is it truly that serious? How serious do those spears look to you? Taviti asked.
No. Nalima Rao, reading from A Shipwreck in Fiji. Okay, Michael, take it away.
Well, one of the themes in The Watch Night is misunderstandings. People who have faith, people who have no faith, First Nations people, settler people, people who have a secret, people who don't. So I'm just going to read one of those misunderstandings. The character Thomas Gunson is also based on a real-life early pioneering explorer, and he's just having an encounter with Una Farrey's mother, who's also based on a real person. The tea was pleasant, and Mrs. Farrey didn't seem to mind that he was not a fellow who rabbited on when there was nought to say. He'd almost finished his cup and was wondering if he'd have to accept a second when she spoke. "Might I impose on you?" Mrs. Farrey asked, pushing the pot within his reach. Gunson placed his cap down gently, yet it scraped. "I'm sure whatever it is, Mr. Temple can assist," he said. "Mr. Temple was not there when my daughter saw the angel," Mrs. Farrey said. Gunson sighed and tried to push off visions of the young woman's senseless form above him when he'd hauled her through the cave, shirt open right to her navel, and the way she'd raved. "How is she?" he asked. Mrs. Farrey considered the question a moment, looking at her lap. "She sleeps most of the time," she said. "I fear we won't see her hail this side of the revival." Gunson had no words plain enough and resorted to swallowing. These were the moments where some semblance of faith might serve him, yet he couldn't bring himself to promise something that may never come to pass. All he had was his experience of people lost, broken, and brought low by this rough country. He'd seen too many expire under the hands of preachers to offer anything hopeful. He just knew that the devil was in this land and not in the way that these people reckoned. Even in the life-giving creeks, there was death. And if you wandered too far from water, you could lose your senses and fall off some jagged rock. This good woman was looking for guarantees, but Gunson knew she would find none. Like most of them, she'd sailed from one rotten land for another on a promise that turned out to be a lie. "If she's not done for yet," he said quietly. Then she should be right enough soon. Mrs. Farry leaned closer. She would make a good wife. Gunson got to his feet before he could see whatever earnest look she might be giving him to back up such an unexpected offer. This was the trouble of spending too much time close to homesteads. Before long, someone expected something of him that he just couldn't give.
Michael Berg reading from his novel, The Watch Night. Lainey Anderson.
Thank you. Okay, I don't think you need any context here. Miss Cox was not best pleased to be standing in front of 200 girls at the Medindi School and Kindergarten. The Women's Police Branch was still a woman down. She had an urgent house visit to make to investigate a woman's claims that her 13-year-old niece was being forced to undress in front of her stepfather, and she still hadn't paid a visit to rally poor Nellie Hall in the wake of her suicide attempt. But here she was, at the express instruction of Commissioner Edwards, who was acting under orders from his wife, Roma, who suddenly deemed it imperative that Miss Cox waste a precious Monday morning speaking to some of the most sheltered, spoiled girls in South Australia. For the next half an hour, the policewoman pointed her 5-foot cane at the admittedly polite and polished young ladies with their hands raised, doing her best to truthfully answer their questions. How old are you?
42.
How tall are you?
5'6".
Do you have a gun?
No.
Are you really the first policewoman in the British Empire?
The first employed on the same salary as men, yes.
What do you do?
Protect women and children from harm.
Where do you go to the toilet when you're on patrol?
Public toilets and sometimes restaurants.
What's your cane for?
To stop young men and women from making the worst mistake of their lives.
What's the worst mistake?
Ask your mother when you're a bit older.
My father says the only words you know are 3 feet apart. What does that mean?
Ask your mother that too.
Oh, and that is Lainey Anderson reading from her novel, Murder on North Terrace, and you stopped just short of all the little girls who wanted to be just like her, which was a very nice detail. Now, reading all of your books together, it seems to me that all three of you take on various mythologies. And so, Nalima, in your novel, there's cricket, fairness, empire. They're some of the things that are sort of taken on. And there was a line that made me laugh rather a lot when I got to it. And oops, let me just find it. When there was a discussion about the weapons of British Empire, and Akal says, ah, yes, the mighty British weaponry. We know something about this in India as well. So are you just taking on colonialism?
It's just a small topic. I thought I'd just chuck it in there.
But as well as the, more seriously though, the power of empire is embedded in it, but also the question of independence.
Yes. So in this book, in my first book, I did not really touch the Indigenous Fijian population because I was a bit nervous about it, to be honest. It's not my culture. I didn't feel quite right about going there, but I started to think with the second book that I can't really write books about Fiji without talking about the Indigenous culture. So in this one, there is a lot of there's a theme around the struggles of the Fijians and how they're trying to assert their independence in a country that they see as being taken over, not just by the Europeans, but also by this huge influx of Indians, people they didn't ask to be brought to their country. By the end of the indentured labour period, there were 60,000 Indians taken to Fiji as indentured labourers, and only about 26,000 of those went back to India. They're big families. Everyone had big families. The Fijians had big families. The Indians had big families. But at one point, there were more Indians. Indians became the majority. It was like 51% of the population was Indian. So the Fijians in 1915 are starting to see this happening. So they're trying to assert their independence, and they're trying to assert that they should have economic power in the country. And then you've got a Carl who's seeing the same thing happening in India and the Indian independence movements that are going on. So there are a few conversations around the comparing and contrasting what's happening in the two countries.
Nalima Rao, whose novel is A Shipwreck in Fiji. I'm Kate Evans, and you're listening to a summer edition of ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, where we're talking historical crime fiction. Now, back to Lainey Anderson and the real World War I policewoman, Kate Cox.
When I was researching Kate Cox, I realised very quickly that she was a complete paradox in so many ways. She was aloof, but she was incredibly empathetic, and in today's terms we would say she had an amazing EQ. She was all about prevention, but she didn't believe in birth control. She believed that motherhood was the closest thing on earth to God. Of course, abortion was illegal. So then I started exploring different paradoxes, and Adelaide itself is a paradox. You know, the city of churches that had vastly more pubs than any churches. You know, it had, in Kate's day, it had opium dens beneath temperance halls, you know, in the same street as temperance halls. It had brothels.
Michael, you've already partly answered this question about taking on mythologies about Australian history in your fiction, because you've already talked about the including Aboriginal people in the story, women's stories. And so I'm going to ask you a slightly different question, which is, as a fiction writer, what responsibility do you hold to the past?
Oh, wow. That is a good one. I think, look, it's a paradoxical. I can only give a paradoxical answer because I'm a writer of fiction, but I am also a journalist. One of the greatest compliments I ever had about my debut novel, Tank Water, was that it was journalistic prose, and I like that. I think I've become a better journalist from writing fiction, and I know that journalism has informed my fiction. It was a chase for facts and truth, The Watch Night. I felt a very great responsibility to the tradition, the oral traditions of Janolan. It's an unbroken tradition, the oral histories of Janolan, until this year, because there's great change out of the caves in terms of the permanent guides that take people through those dark and dangerous places. So I always felt a responsibility to the women and men who shared the stories with me when I learned as a guide. I felt a great responsibility to the Burra Burra people, and I was very privileged to be given support by Kazane Brown, who is a Burra Burra knowledge holder, an award-winning historian. Her submission to the state inquiry about the raising of the Warragamba Dam wall is worth reading in its own right, and it certainly opened my eyes. And it was Auntie Sharon Hall of the Gundungurra people who inspired me to change perspectives. I commuted to Janolan Caves for all of those years down that winding road, and it gave me so much thinking time. But talking to Auntie Sharon showed me that that was not the original way to Janolan. It was up the rivers, the watercourses that were mapped in their stories. And as I said earlier, it's up to us to ask them. The Burra Burra and the Gundungurra people have accessible ways of us learning that, and it's not my job to share them. But you asked me about loyalty, and it is to those storytellers. I know that The Watch Night it hits the pause button on history a bit, as I said, in a vessel of a novel, which I think is a distraction. So that's all I can provide, is a distraction, a chance to think, a chance to be exposed to some different stories. But my loyalty comes right back to Jane Falls. She, hearing her story, which I did on a training tour, it's an author's loyalty to the art and the craft and the heart of storytelling.
That relationship between the research that you do and the imaginative practice, because you are both historians and researchers and you are novelists. How do you understand that tension, and does it give you a sense of what you owe to the past?
My story is a little bit complicated because Kate Cox isn't really known as a policewoman in South Australia, but she's very well known for the Kate Cox Mothers and Babies Home, which she founded when she finished as a policewoman in 1936 at the age of 60. So she had, it was quite incredible. She was, she established it decades before Whitlam's single parent pension, and she wanted young women to be given agency over whether they had their babies adopted or not. So while she was superintendent of the Mothers and Babies Home, only 37% of babies were adopted, and the others were allowed to live at the home for 3 and 4 years until their mothers got themselves in a position where they could take the children home. When she died in 54, the home was posthumously named in her honour, the Kate Cox Mothers and Babies Home. And by 1970, up to 90% of babies were being adopted out. So in 2011, when there was the federal inquiry into the Stolen Generations and Forgotten Children, Uniting Care Wesley in South Australia was the first organisation in Australia to unreservedly apologise to women and any children who had been either coerced or forced to give up their babies. So I felt an incredible sense of responsibility, as Michael spoke to any, not just to her family, but to anyone invested in her story, that I try and be as honest about her and her, to try and be as true as I possibly could be to the kind of person she was, even though my Kate Cox is only inspired by her. I had to try and be true to her. And that's just not just a responsibility, I think, to ourselves and to people invested in that story, but to readers as well. You know, readers deserve to be, when we're sort of bringing real life back, readers deserve to be given as broad a picture and as true a tale as possible.
What a powerful response. Thank you. And in the couple of minutes we have left, Nalima, I'm curious whether having the sort of added family history, even though you haven't included, you know, people that you're related to, if that adds to the weight of the storytelling, or whether you can just imagine this handsome, I imagine he is handsome, Sikh man striding through the past.
Yes. Dev Patel is who we have cast in our in our wildest
Thank
fantasies.
You.
So, yes.
That'd do.
Yeah,
he'll be all right.
I have also told my nephew that when he grows up, he can do it. So for me, yes, the family, when I started writing this, I was so nervous. I was so nervous that I wasn't a good enough Indian to write this book. Like, I, as a Fijian Indian, had imposter syndrome about these books because I grew up in Australia. I didn't focus on my heritage until I started researching for these books. So, I was very nervous, but it's been received so well. And I think I think what happened is there was a lot of shame around the indenture. So my grandparents, my parents, they didn't talk about it, but my generation is starting to talk about it more and more. So there's a thing called Girmuth Day. So Girmuth is the term for the contract. It's actually a bastardization of the word agreement. So the Indians didn't know how to say agreement, so they said Girmuth. There's a Girmuth Day now in Fiji and in Mauritius as well. So there are there's more awareness. There's more. People are wanting to talk more about these stories. So. It's actually been really well received, and by the Indigenous Fijian community as well. I think Fijians are just really happy that somebody is, or that people are writing about Fiji, not just as an exotic location to sort of go on holidays or as an exotic backdrop, but about putting Fiji as a central character.
And here at the Bad Sydney Crime Festival and on ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, I'm Kate Evans, here with writers Lainey Anderson, Michael Berg and Nalima Rao. Please do thank them all.
There'll be more bookish conversation all through summer here on ABC Radio National. So keep reading, keep listening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.